Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Freedom of Association Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 19, 2010, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Christian Legal Society v. Martinez. The question in this case is whether a public university's law school may deny funding and other benefits to a religious student organization because the organization refuses to abide by a non-discrimination policy that would prevent it from requiring its officers and voting members to agree with its core beliefs, including beliefs concerning homosexual conduct. To discuss the case, we have University Chicago School of Law and New York University Law School Professor Richard A. Epstein, who was counsel of record on a brief submitted by the Cato Institute in support of the petitioner. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Hello, this is Richard Epstein at the University of Chicago, and I'm here to talk today about a case in which I wrote an amicus curiae brief for the Cato Institute, along with Ilya Shapiro and Evan Turgagon. And the topic is the case of Christian Legal Society, chapter of the University of California, Hastings College of Law, a mouthful, against Leo P. Martinez, who is the dean of the institution. And the question has to do with the most difficult issues associated with freedom of association. And unfortunately, I don't think that the really important issues got out in the Supreme Court oral argument, and so therefore I'm quite at sea as to figuring out exactly what kind of an opinion they will write. The case had its origins in two policies that were created by the Hastings Law School. One of them is a sort of a general take-all-comers policy, which announces that any and all organizations have to accept into membership any and all individuals who apply, regardless of any disagreements between the stated obligations and the stated objectives of the institution and the particular beliefs of the person in question. And the other one, a more narrow written policy, starts to argue that there is, in fact, impermissible for any institution to discriminate against various kinds of people on certain kinds of grounds, such as race, creed, sexual orientation, and the like. The Christian Legal Society is, in fact, an organization of devout Christians who take a series of vows concerning chastity and marriage. They're supposed to disdain any same-sex or homosexual relationships and any kind of activities outside of marriage. And if you wish to be an officer or a member of the directors of this organization, according to the organization, you have to subscribe to these kinds of beliefs. You can be somebody who has violated them in the past, so long as your current set of beliefs is consistent with the objectives of the organization. There's an obvious tension that takes place between the policies, either the broader or the narrower policy of Hastings Law School on the one hand and the objectives of the Christian Legal Society on the other. And sure enough, when the Christian Legal Society decided to apply for status as a registered student organization, they received, shall we say, a chilly reception from the Hastings Law School, and they were not permitted access to key facilities, including the bulletin board that was used by various student organizations to broadcast their events, the use of the school logo, the use of school rooms and facilities, and so forth. There is some kind of a dispute, as a matter of fact, as to when these policies began and how consistently they were applied, but I think it's probably agreed on all sides that there is no question that the Christian Legal Society was in fact disfavored by the administration. Michael McConnell, formerly of the 10th Circuit and now at the Stanford Law School, said in effect that whenever the organization requested a room, it always got itself a runaround. So one of the difficulties that it turns on this particular case is that the justices were genuinely perplexed over the issue as to which of these two policies applied, the broader one, taking all comers, or the narrow one, having to do with discrimination on particular grounds. They weren't sure whether or not the difference in the policies made a difference with respect to the outcome, and they weren't quite sure exactly what the pattern and practice of behavior was underneath the policies as stated, because there was some confusion inside the record. And the stipulations that were put forward in this case therefore became the subject of an intense amount of discussion, most of it completely unproductive for a general audience. talking about the larger issues, I think it was clear that there was a real division of opinion on how one ought to think about it. On the one hand, there were those people who sort of believed in formal equality and said that if the religious organizations are subject to the same kind of treatment as everybody else, what's the big deal? Justice Sotomayor intimated in her questions to Professor McConnell that a little bit of discrimination against these organizations, like the Christian Legal Society, would not be a terrible thing so long as they had some access at some time to other kinds of people, and so on down the line. I think it's probably going to come out that these practices in question will be struck down, and what I'm going to do now for the next 4 or 5 minutes is to explain how it is that I would think about this, and in saying these remarks, I'm going to sort of track the arguments that were made in the amicus curiae brief that I helped author for the Cato Institute. And the first question I think that one wants to do is to recognize that there's a real issue of unconstitutional conditions in this particular case. Can the state impose certain kinds of conditions upon individuals which say that you can have equal admission into our law school activities only if you surrender what would normally be regarded as First Amendment rights of freedom of association, which are reserved for people who have strong religious beliefs? So in order to make this argument go, what you have to do is to first understand the way the world looks if it turns out that the state is simply trying to impose direct regulations on the Christian Legal Society as to its membership and practice, and then ask whether or not the kinds of tactics that they cannot impose as a matter of direct regulation, they can impose on the society if it wishes to gain access to the facilities of Hastings. So let's just take those two parts. On the first part, the Supreme Court has, given its own concern with the anti-discrimination law, developed a rather elaborate tripartite classification. For ordinary kinds of economic operations and so forth, the general norm is unexceptionable today, which is the Title VII rule, that the state, without question, can in fact require employers to hire without regard to race, creed, religion, sex, and so forth. There are a bunch of narrow exceptions to that for bona fide or occupational qualifications that we needn't trouble ourselves with. The key point is that it is generally regarded that the non-discrimination law trumps any claim of freedom of contract or association to the extent that you deal with economic associations. At that point, however, the issue becomes more clouded, because what about expressive organizations which in fact do not have economic gain as their objective? And these come in two flavors. The first, which is similar to the JCs, a famous 1984 case, are those broad-based organizations which are kind of do-gooder operations. And what they do is they have a large membership and they're designed to work on projects of civil reformation of one kind or another. And anybody who wants to sort of help in slum clearance is welcome to join the organization. And the JCs at one point refused to let women in. And in a case called Roberts, Justice Brennan, writing back in about 1984 or so, said, look, the anti-discrimination norm trumps the freedom of association policy or value in this particular case, and we could afford the JCs to admit women into their ranks. And, you know, that was probably going to happen anyhow, and it certainly was forced. And generally speaking, we have a fairly broad definition of a variety of expressive organizations that can be subject to the anti-discrimination norm. The next case in the line, however, is a case called Dale, having to do with the Boy Scouts of America. And this was a question as to whether or not the Boy Scouts could exclude from its ranks of members or ranks of leaders those individuals of a homosexual orientation. And what the court said under these circumstances is that this is not just a plain old expressive association like we had in Roberts. This is a case in which there's a very strong set of moral commitments with respect to practices. Justice Rehnquist made it clear that we don't cross-examine these people within an inch of their lives. And so the result was that with this kind of an organization, given the fact that it had these strong moral codes, the balance flipped over. Now freedom of association dominated the anti-discrimination norm. And at this point, the question is, how do you fit into that tripartite grid, the Christian Legal Society? And this question, at least, is a no-brainer. They clearly have more fundamental religious beliefs. They have a greater degree of religious coherence, and it depends much more to them. It matters much more to them than it does to any other group. And so the answer is, I think it would be clearly unconstitutional if the state decided that you guys can't have an organization like this. You have to let atheists into your ranks or something of the sort. The question then comes is, it's not direct regulation. It's admission into a university. And so that's where the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions come in. There's an intermediate case which bears a little bit of mention, and that's the set of circumstances where it turns out that the Christian Legal Society wishes to have a small parade on a public street, and the question is whether or not they can be denied a permit on the grounds that they won't admit atheists into their ranks. And we've had a bunch of cases on this, most chiefly a case called Hurley, where it seems pretty clear that if you're a religious organization, you can't be the only one to use the public roads, but you can keep out of your parade anybody who wishes to express a belief system which is inconsistent with your own. So the state cannot use its monopoly powers over the roads to favor those people who have a view on sexual relationships and same-sex marriage, which is consistent with that of the dominant group. It has to let in all groups equally. But it will be said, a university and a law school is rather different from a public highway because it has all sorts of complicated relationships, including the provision of extensive educational services. And the answer to that, I think, comes in two parts. The first part says is what we're going to do is distinguish between the deeply educational portion of their mission and all the other ancillary services that are supplied, so that the Christian Legal Society cannot say, look, we're a part of this law school, even if we have only 10 people here, so we insist that our curriculum be taught, that you have devout Christians as part of your faculty and so forth, that you cover courses that we're interested in and the like. Generally speaking, nobody wants the, shall we say, the courts to get involved in the way in which the school organizes its educational mission. But this case involves something above and beyond that. Namely, it involves the question of what we're going to do with respect to those non-essential activities inside the law school, to wit, the cases in which somebody wants to use a classroom or a bulletin board and so forth. And the argument that the Christian Legal Society makes, which I believe is correct, is that with respect to these non-essential activities where the school's functions are ministerial and no section of beliefs are at stake, set of beliefs are at stake, the correct rule is to say you have to have a non-discrimination policy. If you're going to put outlaw, which is the gay and lesbian group and the transgender group, on your bulletin board, you've got to put us. If you're going to put the whole question of Hispanic-only groups like La Raza or BALSA, the Black Association, so forth, on your roster, you have to put us there. I don't think that there was a really strong answer to that question. The counsel that argued the case for the Hastings essentially said, you've got to give us deference in the way in which we run our law school, to which I think the right answer is you get deference where it's needed on curricular matters, but you don't get it on these ministerial matters where you look much more like a highway and much less like a classroom in which there's intensive intellectual discourse. How are the Supreme Court going to decide this? I think probably the majority of the court, when they get through all the procedural stuff, will in effect side with the Christians on this particular issue. Justice Scalia, I think, summarized it best when he said, look, the whole relationship is kind of weird. How is it that you can force people to take into their organization those people who are antithetical to everything for which they stand? They could take over the organization and disembowel it from the inside. The answer that came from the other side, well, this hasn't happened yet. And I think the answer is maybe it hasn't happened, but we want to make darn sure that it won't happen. And the way we do that is to give them equal access on these particular points. So my guess is that the winning argument will essentially be that with respect to the sort of activities involved here, what we do is we treat the school as though it's, quote-unquote, a limited public forum looking enough like a highway that the same rules that we use on highways in connection with unconstitutional conditions will apply here. But this is somewhat of an open question. The argument was quite chaotic, and nobody seemed to get down to the exact central issues in the case, so a lot has to be left for speculation. Anyhow, I hope these remarks are of help to you, and once again, it's Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago saying thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.